People before profit.
The best of Drive at 5.
Dublin's Q102.
We can say hello to Coleman Doctor. Hello, Coleman. Thank you. Good to have you back. Coleman is the child and adolescent psychotherapist and the author of Cop On, What It Is Your Child Needs to Thrive and Survive in Today's World. If there's something you'd like us to ask Coleman, by the way, just to say to you, the text is 57102. Text costs 20 cents. We pass it on. Or if you want to respond to something that we are talking about, same number, 57102. Text to Dublin's Q102 for 20 cents. Over the long bank holiday weekend, you may have heard on the news that Britain's Prince Harry opened up about how difficult it was for him when his mum died 20 years ago, Coleman. He was, 12 or something then? And he admitted that he had to go and talk to people and it was tough and he'd have counselling and all the rest. And he has been universally congratulated for opening up about it now because he's such a... he'd be such a good role model for young people. Would you share all of that?
I would. I think it's great when anybody who kind of, I suppose, serves as an icon can kind of admit to struggling. What was interesting about this was, this is about a response to a bereavement. So, I mean, we can talk about that in terms of mental health and mental illness. That was a life event that caused him to be mentally distressed. And he reached out in that time to get some support to negotiate that traumatic event that had happened to him. And I think, you know, losing someone is really difficult to kind of come to terms with. But, and it, of course, it would compromise our mental health for a period of time. But it may indeed be a situational crisis that you just need a lift up with in order to kind of keep going and get on with it. And again, we're not talking about mental, because sometimes we talk about mental health as this kind of thing that people aren't really sure of. What's mental distress? What's mental illness? What's just being mentally healthy? And I think for Prince Harry's story, I think it was just, it was a life event that really was difficult for him to cope with. He was a young boy at the time. Yeah. He was finding his own identity.
Is 12, at age 12, for that to happen to someone at age 12, is that worse than, say, at age 14?
It's very hard to say whether something is worse or not. I mean, if you think about it, the trajectory of childhood is so much more accelerated than it is in adulthood. So the difference between a 12-year-old and a 22-year-old is far different than the difference between a 42- and 52-year-old. So when anything happens in that time that disrupts that development or takes you out of that for whatever period of time through a mental health problem, it has greater consequences because of what you're missing out on or what developmental steps there's going to be a gap that you may be emotionally maybe struggling with something, and that may cause a lag in your development in which you have to kind of regain and get back to it. So for any young person who is any age really, because the growth spurts even between 3 and 13 are massive in terms of the neurons are really firing, children are really developing a sense of their world, moral compass, resilience, all of these really important things. So anything that disrupts that period of time is crucial to have an early kind of identifying it and remedy it as soon as possible.
I was just going to ask you then, so somebody is listening and they're in this situation, or they may have a niece or a nephew who's in that situation, should they jump in now, or should they wait for signs, or when is the right time to intervene?
Again, I suppose if you're looking at something like, for example, let's take Prince Harry's who has suffered a bereavement, to feel upset and lost and maybe sleep problems and appetite problems and motivation issues after a loss of that magnitude is completely understandable. It's a very normal reaction to such a life event. And oftentimes we kind of describe a normal grief reaction as just needing the support of family and friends to kind of rally around you, provide you with that nurturance that you need to get through that period of time. In cases where that isn't resolving at a period of time that you might expect it to, or if there are kind of prolonged elements of grief that are not seen to be mending, I would certainly think that if going to speak to someone who, and it's very difficult for child bereavement when you're in a system where everybody is grieving, because you don't want to burden people who are also experiencing their own loss with your difficulties. And that's why an outside person who isn't being affected by it may offer you a vehicle or an avenue to discuss the stuff that's really, really troublesome. But I've worked with children for 20 years, and many who've experienced a kind of a traumatic life event, and for many it does affect deeply, but not something that they can't find a way through and find a way around. And it might just be as I say, a kind of a low-scale intervention that doesn't class as mental illness or anything like it, but just somebody who needs some support to try and make sense of it with someone who's objective to the situation. And then there are other children who would have a more abnormal grief reaction, and that may last for quite a long time, where they're struggling to re-enter their own world. And at that point, yes, I mean, but with any sort of childhood mental health problem or mental distress, early intervention is key, but it's not key to overreact to something that is just a life event.
Okay, our guest is Colman Nocta, the child and adolescent psychotherapist, Drive at 5 here in Dublin's Q102. Just ask you just to go back to something you said, Colman, about mentally healthy. Mm-hmm. How do you know that you're healthy? You know, the other thing is, we have all these other things about how, you have BMI or our waistline or, you know, all the kind of physical things. How do you know whether you're actually mentally healthy?
Or you just hit on the greatest challenge of what it is to be a mental health practitioner. Like, we don't have x-rays. We don't have blood tests that come back and say you definitively have this or not. We depend completely on our observation of somebody's thoughts, feelings and behaviours. And in some ways, the large amount of that is guesswork in some respects. And for me, I always think of it as a spectrum. So you've got mental health on one side, mental health problems in the middle, and mental illness on the other end.
Okay.
And we all experience mental health problems. So we all have situational crises, whether it be, as I say, kind of bereavement, it might be a row, it might be a break of a relationship, it might be a job loss, that needs support in order to find our way back to mentally healthy. Mentally healthy is defined as someone who can contribute to who can function and contribute to their own lives in a meaningful way. I mean, it's really blurry and vague and wishy-washy. But if I can cope with functioning with my everyday life, I can generally be concerned or can categorise as mentally healthy, where something starts to disrupt my functioning. So I'm not sleeping well, my grades in school are dropping, my relationships and my family are suffering. Those kind of dysfunctional areas are the red flags that suggest a mental health problem. And when those mental health problems don't resolve and the person has an ongoing or enduring experience of that, then it can develop into a mental illness. And I would make the comparison that, you know, and I would speak to a lot of young people about, you know, and I'd say, if you went to visit your friend and she'd just broken up from a relationship and she's sitting at home and she's really upset and she's listening to sad music and she's eating Ben and Jerry's and she looks really, really distraught, would you bring her to the GP? And they would all say no, because it's a reaction to an event that's just happened. But then I said, if you revisited her in 6 months' time and she's still wearing the same tracksuit, still listening to the same CD and hasn't left the house since, would you bring her then? And they would say yes. And it's not that the severity of the symptom is any different, but it is the length of time that someone isn't finding a way to cope or find a way out of it.
What about younger people?
Yes.
Because I was reading a poll recently that teachers were saying they've experienced panic attacks, anxiety and even depression in kids as young as 4. How does that manifest itself?
It's really interesting, because we call it child and adolescent mental health services, but we kind of oftentimes forget that childhood mental health problems exist, and they do. In the very small infant, you usually see that through feeding and sleeping disorders, so the child is not sleeping.
So when they're a baby, or when they're...
Infants who might be distressed following a hospitalisation, whatever it might be, you're really depending on behaviours around that time. Then we'll see, kind of as a preschool age child, you usually would see a kind of a lot of difficulties around things like early onset kind of ADHD, autism, developmental delays, where a child's not hitting the milestones that they perhaps should, and they kind of create that kind of early childhood. Then you've got the entry into school, and that's where you see the onset of what we kind of describe as separation anxiety.
Okay.
So you really see the child who's, you know, really suffering with anxiety.
And how do you see that in a child? Do they get angry, or do they become withdrawn, or
it can be all sorts of things. And again, you think of it through the lens of attachment. So a child who maybe doesn't want to go to school, doesn't want to go into play school, and is kind of prizing off the mum's leg. Children can be incredibly, their tantrums can be really, really difficult at that age to try and manage. I know parents who would have had 3 or 4 months of screaming tantrums in school, and teachers trying to manage that. And, you know, a lot of separation anxiety can be really, really difficult to manage. But it can be a mixture of anxiety and anger. So the child may hit the parents, or they may lash out, but they've no sense of emotional regulation. So you're just going to see for all the world, the tantrum and the feelings being expressed. What happens then is between the ages of 7 and 12, we've called what's called a latency period. And that's where emotionality tends to go underground a little bit. So that age group are very rule-bound, and it's all very clear and black and white, and cowboys and Indians and cops and robbers. And so the emotionality tends to drift a little bit away. And then adolescence, the toddler returns. So that you have the emotional dysregulation that arrives, and the adolescent is much more popular. But issues around anxiety and depression, we're seeing quite a lot more of that in smaller children and younger children than ever before.
So how would a parent know then that, say, for example, a child starting junior infants and they're kicking off, they don't want to go in the door, and you see that with some kids happening for the whole of the first term. So is it when it becomes in the second term they're still doing it, you sort of go, there might be something here, or how do you know when to explore it further?
Well, again, I think any parent in that situation is trying something different every day to try and, you know, maybe let dad bring them this day and me bring them next day, and trying to manage a way in which they can get the child
in. But a parent had the feeling as well that they didn't prepare the child well enough.
Yeah, and I think we can look at
ourselves and take that responsibility. Is it properly the parent's responsibility?
I would say, and I always say this, I don't think parents are always part of the problem. I think they are always part of the solution, but not the problem. And some children are just born with a temperament that is highly strung, and there could be any matter of means. A child may not want to go to school because they're nervous of the school environment, but they also, there's another reason which we don't think about. A child may not want to leave mum, so they're worried about what will happen to mum when they're in school, so they want to stay at home for that reason, and that is a form of anxiety as well. So you've kind of got this kind of enmeshed attachment relationship that can sometimes make that any sort of separation very difficult. Again, it's kind of gently weaning the child from mum and from that kind of comfort zone into something, but in a supportive way. It's not about rupturing the child from what is safe and plonking them in. That can have other kind of traumatic event effects on the child. So it's about being really creative about it. As to when to intervene, I think you'd be intervening all the time. As to when to get professional help, I'm guessing towards the end of that first term, if things weren't resolving, I would have parents contact me at that stage and say, how can we manage this? This is not getting any better, and we thought it would have resolved by now.
How about like aggressiveness in kids, and sort of kids that are aggressive, they know they're being aggressive and they shouldn't be, but they're sort of doing it anyway?
Traditionally, that aggressiveness and tantrums, that again comes back to emotional regulation. And I would say to you, look, we regulate our children, their appetite, their sleep, we give them routines about all of the kind of behavioural things. It's very hard to regulate emotion. So a very emotional child who doesn't have the language to communicate what they feel will behave. And we all do that. You know, if you've ever kind of got so frustrated that you've banged the table, that's where words have failed. So behaviour takes over. And for small children who don't have a lexicon of terms, when words fail, behaviour takes over. So they will throw something, fling something, hit in order to make their point. There's something that they're trying to communicate that isn't being heard. And it's not the fault of the parents, it's not listening. It's maybe the fault of the child who's not able to articulate it yet. So in any of those kind of tantruming, high escalation issues, it's about having a language with your child to teach them about emotion. And it takes long, it's not a quick fix. But any sort of those extreme behaviours are usually around emotional dysregulation. And your hope is that in time, the child who tantrums at 3 because they don't get the buttons in Tesco's, by the time they're 19, they won't do that.
Well,
anymore.
Hopefully they won't. Anyway.
Dublin's Q102.
Coleman Octus with us, child and adolescent psychotherapist. Now I want to talk about promises to kids, Coleman. And you know this scenario, if you're a good boy, Coleman, I will give you, this will happen, and whatever it might be. And on two levels, I guess, is sort of managing kids with that tactic, and then secondly, perhaps not delivering on the payoff when it happens or doesn't happen.
Yeah, that's commonly known as the when-then command. So you kind of say, when you do this, then you can get that. And again, I think in terms of you're incentivizing a child to do something and they do it, then you must deliver on it. But a child also needs to learn how to be flexible when plans or promises don't happen. And it's unusual, it's odd to kind of think that disappointment is an opportunity, but it is for children to learn how to cope with disappointment or change of plans or encouraging them to be flexible. So it's not that big a crisis if something doesn't turn out the way in which it was promised to be. And that could be for a whole series of reasons.
Mm. But wouldn't you explain why, though?
Absolutely. And a child needs to I suppose, understand that and learn how to kind of renegotiate the reality that now lies there. In terms of promising, I would say where something, for example, where a promise to a child is can be really detrimental is, for example, if, I don't know, if parents are separated and dad says he's going to pick the child up at 2 o'clock
and doesn't show up.
And the child's sitting there from 9 waiting and then dad doesn't turn up. That is something that, you know,
that's really
that's a different sort of promise.
A different sort of promise, but yeah. The promise that it, you know, if you clean your room, we'll go to the park, and the child cleans their room, you should really go to the park because that was part of the deal. And if you want to incentivize a child to engage with you, you're much better off where you can to form an alliance.
But you see, sometimes parents though hope like never mention it again and hope the child will forget. Child will not forget.
Unlikely. Mm. And if child even doesn't mention it, they will. I suppose it will resonate with them, and I was talking to a colleague recently about the plight of the good child. We kind of oftentimes think the good child is grand, but for a child who maybe isn't demanding and isn't very troublesome throughout their kind of early childhood into their teens, that child may not voice that you've let them down. They may not even bring it to your attention, but they will feel it. And they can oftentimes be an internalizer. So they tend to kind of take things, you know, they behave not because they want to, but because they're too anxious not to behave. And there's a kind of a sense that they're almost, they're hyper-independent. They're kids who are getting their own lunch ready. They're, you know, on time. They do their homework without much. Mm. They're kind of the autonomous children.
And dad stands there and says, what a trooper, makes his own lunch. He's
absolutely
fantastic.
But then the kid that's being incentivized by, I don't know, a new bat cave or whatever, is they're getting stuff.
Sure.
All the time.
It's because bribe.
They're bribed, whereas the kid that doesn't need that bribe isn't getting anything.
Well, holding on to a promise and bribing someone is different.
But is it, though?
If you have, say, for example,
I don't know, a 4 or 5 year old who you want to, for the next month, you want to get them to do their homework, whatever, for school, and you say at the end, I will get you whatever Batman toy. Okay,
give them a stamp every week then.
Do you know what I mean? Like, is that a good thing to do, or is that just promising material goods for, or does it not get them on the right track?
It does. I mean, you're incentivizing a good behavior by offering a reward. Now, the issue with any sort of behavioral reward scheme, and you'll have lots of people who'll say, I tried that, it didn't work. The manner in which you do that is key to its success. So the idea of an incentive-based chart is way more effective than one that's negatively based, that you lose things. Something like asking a five-year-old, for your example, for a month's good behavior is beyond their capacity to even try and behave for a month. They haven't got the long-term concept of our cognitive ability to manage that, so they may fail on the basis of that. And many of our kind of star chart and incentive-based charts are just misdelivered. There's inaccuracies in them that make them impossible. By over-promising really expensive gifts after the first week, you run out of things to do in the second week. But I would say in any star chart, you know, try and start off where they win something or get something in the first week. So something that they can do well, say for example, you're trying to get bedtimes ready and they can do their teeth and they do their teeth really well. And so if they get 5 stars for 5 nights of doing their teeth, plus the others, the other stars, the other things.
Sounds like you need a sticker book, Venetia.
Yeah, but you need to have success. So if the child is doing all these and they're getting 4 stickers and 3 stickers and it's 3 weeks and I haven't got anything from it, then that loses its value.
Yeah. So incentive bring it forward.
It's really about giving the early quick wins and then escalating into the more
complex. That's not all that different from adults, really, Colm, is it?
Absolutely not. No. And again, I think, like, we are, as children, we're programmed to, you know, press the button and the green light. So if you do something and you get a response from it, you're likely to do more of it. And in early childhood, especially in toddlers, it is largely conditioning. What you're trying to do is get them to associate a positive with something that they should be doing. And the more they do it, the more positive things get.
Is it good for sort of habit forming, though? Do you know the way if they're on a sort of the track of being in good form and doing really well and doing their homework or whatever, don't they sort of forget then that they sort of once upon a time didn't like doing their homework?
Yeah, I mean, habit forming is two-way. I mean, if a child will only do something if they get something from it, they're not forming the habit of doing something for the sake of well-being or the family. And I mean, there's lots of people who would be critical of offering incentives like pocket money for chores or things like that, because that should be done in the spirit of you're part of this family and you do it without reward. But I think getting a child on the right track with an incentive, what I would say is, and this is an important one, one of the incentives for lots of children should be time with their parents. So you and I will go to the park and we will do that together, rather than a magazine or something that will be handed to them.
Yeah.
It's about, because oftentimes what a child at that age wants is visibility. They want to be noticed and they want to be recognised, and it's far more effective to get a pat on the back and a really reassuring word of praise from someone and some time with them than perhaps a plasticky magazine that will probably end in the
trash.
We'll
just ask you one more thing, and just in that vein as well, but homework. How can you sell homework to be the wholesome, 100% healthy, good for the rest of your life thing that is, when it's pure drudgery, really?
Homework is the bane of so many people's lives.
I know.
And you really would, and especially probably in my role, you kind of consider the benefits of it in terms of as a family disruption compared to its intellectual benefits.
It's desperate.
Its strength is in its habit forming, so that the child will get into the swing of doing stuff on their own at home. Oftentimes homework doesn't involve you on your own. It involves two parents and a screaming match and everything else that goes with it.
But the thinking there is, we could do a lot of this in school.
Yes.
But this is, we want you to do work at home. So this is to learn to have me conditioned, as the child is conditioned into the routine of it. Is that it?
Yes, and it's a condition into kind of that work, school doesn't end when it's over. So that there's other things that you need to do to work towards.
And a parent then, how can a parent make that sound, you know, more wholesome?
I think that's a stretch. I don't know. I wouldn't have the answer to that.
Yeah.
I think you can sell the benefits of it to an older child.
Yeah.
You can perhaps, I mean,
but someone 9 or 10, you know.
I believe in early childhood that homework should be tokenistic. It shouldn't involve that level of investment.
You know,
but if you've a 7-year-old who's doing an hour a night, I mean, that's beyond what it should be. But again, and it doesn't account for the child who maybe has dyslexia or has a learning difficulty, where it takes them three times the length of time. And again, I think it can be quite a punitive experience. But I suppose when you deal with teenagers, the notion of having to get them involved in study for state exams and stuff, if they've been in the swing of that, it can really help.
Yeah.
But again, I would say to most parents, you can't make your child learn and you can't make them study. And it's one of the things that bugs us as parents that we, you know, if you lock them in the room for 2 hours, there's nothing to say they're going to take that book out and read it.
Yeah.
And it is about us trying to incentivize them to choose the right the right options themselves.
If there's a night, say you've a junior or senior infant who absolutely right, wrong, no interest, doesn't want to do it, they're tired or whatever, should you just leave it and just say to the teacher, look, not a good night for doing it, end of? Or should you try and get them to do it or do it the weekend?
I think in exceptional circumstances where the child is genuinely unable, where it's and again, this is the trick of parenting, deciding what is unwilling and what's unable. And you know, You challenge unwillingness.
We call it the will not do. The will not do.
I would worry about creating a split between what they're expected to do in school and what you expect of them, parents.
Yeah.
And I would say, in any parenting situation, if you're going to be strict, both be strict. And if you're going to be lenient, both be lenient.
Yeah.
The difficulty is when there's a difference.
Yeah.
And children find that confusing.
Good cop and bad cop.
So if school are saying you need to do this and mom's saying no, you don't, that creates confusion.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there. Time always runs away with us. Coleman, thank you very much indeed for popping in. Coleman Nocter, child and adolescent psychotherapist. You hear him here at Dublin's Q102 and Drive at 5. And Coleman is the author of Cop On, What It Is Your Child Needs to Thrive and Survive in Today's World. And if there's something to do with children or adolescents and and their mental balance and mental health, as Coleman was describing it, that you'd like us to deal with in a future programme, let us know. The text is 57102 for 20 cents. We want a bit more space to do it. We're taking them on email, aren't we?
We are. Yes. drive@qno2.ie.
The best of Drive at 5. Phone and text lines are now closed. Dublin's Q102. Drive at 5 with the new Peugeot Expert. Irish Van of the Year 2017. Its mission, your business. Dublin's Q102.